Good morning, everyone. I'm Craig McClure, the Executive Director of the International AIDS Society. This morning is going to be something a little bit different for the conference. We've been trying to increase the dialogue, increase the discussion at this conference. And one thing that we've never done before is have an interactive plenary session. We're thrilled that Dr. Sanjay Gupta has agreed to moderate this session. Sanjay is Senior Medical Correspondent for the Health and Medical Unit at CNN, where he has worked since 2001. In addition to his work for CNN, Dr. Gupta is a member of the staff and faculty of the Department of Neurosurgery at the Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, USA, and performs surgery weekly at Emory University Hospital and Grady Memorial Hospital, where he serves as chief of neurosurgery. Before joining CNN, Gupta was a neurosurgeon at the University of Tennessee's Semmes Murphey Clinic, and before that, the University of Michigan's Medical Center. In 1997, he was chosen as a White House Fellow, one of only 15 fellows appointed, and served as special advisor to the First Lady at that time, Hillary Clinton. In 2004, he attended the International AIDS Conference in Bangkok, Thailand, where he reported on the pandemic for CNN, CNN International, and Headline News. I welcome Dr. Sanjay Gupta.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, I'm excited to be here. Thank you very much for having me. I have attended a few of these conferences now, and can you hear me? Can y'all hear me? Okay. Can you hear me now? All right. I've attended a few of these conferences, and one of the things that we really wanted to do today was give you a chance to be a part of this dialogue as well. And that's a big part of what we're going to be doing over the next hour or so. The theme of this conference, as you know, is a time to deliver. But a second, equally important adjunct to that is the price of inaction. What does it cost if we don't deliver? What does it cost so far in the time that we have not delivered in so many different ways? And those are some of the issues that we're going to be tackling today. We have a crack panel to be able to talk about this. As Craig mentioned, the presentations are going to be shorter today to give us more time to actually have some of the dialogue. But I want to get right to it so that I can give you as much time to be a part of this as well. Let me quickly introduce the panel. Then I'm going to have all of them go up to the lectern and make short presentations. First of all, Mark Haywood is from South Africa. He is a senior researcher and head of the AIDS Law Project at the Center for Applied Studies. Interestingly, he was born in Nigeria, lives in South Africa now, but has a British accent. We'll ask him about that later. Sasha Volgina is from Russia. She was born and raised in St. Petersburg, Russia. She's been the director of a self-support group since 2005, also formed the first treatment activist group in Russia called Front AIDS, and please welcome her as well. Musimbi Kanyoro is from Switzerland. Interestingly, she's the General Secretary of the World YWCA. And I was asking her about this just backstage, and she told me that they actually have the potential to reach 30 million women and girls all the time. They also do some intensive programming in 73 countries, specifically talking about HIV/AIDS. She's going to talk a lot about the issues of morality versus mortality. Please welcome her. And Carol McKay is going to talk about the youth and the future. Now, she lives in Kingston now, was born and raised in Portland, Jamaica, though, has been active in her community to mobilize youngsters as well. She formed her first youth group when she was 15 years old, which prompted Musimbi to ask her, well, how old are you now? Because she does look so young. Please welcome Carol as well. So the way we're going to do this again is we're going to have each of our panelists go up and make short presentations. I'll start with Mark Haywood.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Good morning, everybody. A few days ago, as we watched President Clinton and Bill Gates on this stage, I had a dream of a better picture, which was to see on the stage a similar discussion taking place between President Lula of Brazil, President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, perhaps Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, where Lula would tell Mbeki about the experiences of Brazil in combating HIV and treating people with AIDS, and Tony Blair would offer the resources to make it possible to sustain the Brazilian AIDS program and to make it possible for developing countries to properly tackle this epidemic. And I say that because I think that one of the greatest missing pieces in this conference has been the question of political leadership. Without political leadership, it will not be possible to turn the scientific discoveries that we have heard about into public health interventions that will save the lives of millions of people. So unless we find political leadership, and unless we interrogate the reasons why there is not political leadership, then our response to the AIDS epidemic will be doomed to being less effective than it could be. So what I want to talk about this morning is the importance of political leadership. I want to show you something of what has happened in South Africa looking back. I want to talk for a few minutes about China looking forward. I want to talk about the duties that I believe arise from the recognition that HIV is a human rights issue, where I'll argue that it's not sufficient to merely pay lip service to human rights, but there are active duties that flow from all this talk about human rights. I want to talk about the responsibility of government and the responsibility of society. But I want to start by saying that despite our criticisms of the Declaration of Commitment agreed in New York a few months ago, there was a very telling admission made in that declaration. The admission said we now have the means to reverse the global pandemic and to avert the millions of needless deaths. My question, your question, is are we going to use those means? Will we hold the world's leaders to account to make sure that those millions of deaths are indeed avoided? Much of the first 25 years of the epidemic has been spent creating the means. But we don't want science for science's sake. We want science for public health's sake. We want science to save lives. And I'll say that this is not just a matter that should preoccupy so-called activists. Every health worker needs to be an activist. Every scientist needs to be an activist. Because your duty doesn't stop with the discovery of an antiretroviral drug or a microbicide. It stops at the point that those discoveries are made available to the population generally. So let me tell you a tale of two countries briefly. South Africa, my own country, 5.54 million people officially living with HIV. China, 650,000 people living with HIV, but with a terrible projection of 10 million people living with HIV in China within 4 years' time. And I want to talk about these two countries briefly because I believe that they show what happens without political leadership and what may happen if there is not political leadership in China. One of the things that has struck me, and Peter Peart referred to it yesterday, is tragically how much we have known about this epidemic over the years and how little we have acted on it. In South Africa in 1990, a leader of the ANC who was tragically assassinated a few years later said, "We can't afford to allow the AIDS epidemic to ruin the realization of our dreams." In 1991, researchers pointed to the epidemiology of HIV, showing how South Africa's apartheid migrant labor system could create an environment in which HIV would rapidly spread from so-called risk groups into the so-called general population. Peter Peart said we had the resources. I would say that if we had the will at a much earlier stage, we could have saved many, many thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of life. But in South Africa, we haven't had the political will. In South Africa, we have fought over HIV, over whether HIV causes AIDS, over whether antiretroviral drugs work or whether they're poisonous, over whether nutrition works and so on and so on. And as we've fought, and as we've failed to provide the leadership that is necessary, inexorably this epidemic has grown and grown. And as you can see on this slide, the latest official antenatal statistics show HIV prevalence amongst pregnant women of 30.2%. But even more frighteningly is the deaths that are happening now. This slide is an official statistic produced by Statistics South Africa in our country. It's based upon counting the annual number of recorded deaths based on medical certificates on death. It shows that by 2004, 567,000 people were dying per year, as opposed to 319,000 people per year in 1997. And as you can see, it shows the perverse situation that in my country, more people die between the ages of 20 and 30 than between the ages of 60 and 70. Now, I want to make some hard comments about that, and the comments that I'm about to make are difficult for me to make, but I will make them all the same. It's likely that in the next 2 minutes, what I say, I will be accused of being disloyal to my government and unpatriotic. But what I want to say is that when we fought apartheid, we treated apartheid not as a matter for South Africa alone, but as a matter for the global community. AIDS is a health issue that is not a matter for South African government alone, but a matter for the global community. When this number of people are dying, in the face of anti-leadership and political denial, then the world has to speak up. And the world is not speaking up. President Clinton can't speak about South Africa and the crisis of the AIDS epidemic. Peter Peart can't speak about South Africa and the crisis of the AIDS epidemic. I want to say now that I believe that our Minister of Health should resign. I say that not because I'm disloyal, but because I'm loyal to these people, to the people who are dying at this very minute in poor communities throughout our country and are being deprived of medical services and access to healthcare services. That is a human rights violation. And that cannot be tolerated, and it has to be stopped, and you have to help us to stop it. Silence equals death. This is what our president said in February this year, in the face of the knowledge of the mortality that is taking place because of HIV. It is unacceptable. It is tragic. My last concluding comments turn to another country, China. UNAIDS has pointed to a rapidly expanding HIV epidemic, the possibility of 10 million new infections by 2010. China is very similar in certain circumstances to South Africa. We know who the risk groups are. The epidemiology has been projected. We have internal and external migrancy. We have gender inequality, and we have a government that in many respects has other priorities than AIDS. The question is, will there be 9 million new HIV infections in China in the next 4 years? Will we allow that to happen? Will the global community allow that to happen? It could take place relatively unnoticed. 10 million people would be less than 1% HIV prevalence. It could take place because there's a culture of impunity for human rights violations in the world. It could take place because statistics dull us to the pain and suffering of dying of AIDS. So we need concerted efforts for prevention and treatment. And the record of the Chinese government so far is cause for concern. There's the blood safety scandal. There's the imprisonment of millions of women who are sex workers. There's harassment of civil society activists, imprisonment of people who petition. Almost in conclusion, I want to turn to the question of human rights. The tragedy for people vulnerable to or living with HIV is that the political response to HIV is influenced by the geopolitics of AIDS. When Kofi Annan visited our country in March 2006, he praised the government for many things correctly, but he didn't attack it for its response to AIDS. We need leadership from people like Kofi Annan. This is almost my final slide. This is about the right of access to healthcare services. Compare mortality in South Africa with mortality graphs in the United States and Sweden. This is 21st century Earth, and this is wrong. And this is why, as a matter of human rights, we have to make sure that everything is done to try to ensure that people have access to treatment. I'll skip my last two slides. My concluding question is, we have the means. We've heard in this meeting, we have the means. Will we utilize them? Will we tell the truth? Will we actually ensure that targets are set and monitored and maintained so that in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, real progress is made and real political leadership to confront this epidemic is discovered? Thank you.
Mark Haywood, thank you very much. You got us right into it, for sure. You raised lots of points, lots of questions as well. We'll get to those questions. Reminder to all of you, we're going to open up the audience to questions probably in about 20 to 30 minutes or so. I also want to point out something. This is a large group here, and it's somewhat intimidating for anyone to get up and speak in front of this group. So please keep that in mind as you welcome our next speaker as well, Sasha Volgina. Please welcome her.
Hello, my name is Sasha, and I'm from St. Petersburg, from the Russian Federation. I have worked in advocacy as an activist of Front AIDS movement for access to treatment, and in services as an expert on adherence and community mobilization in treatment models. In Russia, 8 in 10 HIV cases are due to injection drug use, and this is how I myself was infected. I tested HIV positive 7 years ago. All I knew was that I would die soon. I only found out that treatment existed 3 years later. But most of people living with HIV/AIDS in my country still don't know that treatment exists. People often don't receive any post-test counseling. For years, in the AIDS centers in my country, we're just collecting statistics. I used to be the only person I knew who was positive. In recent years, all my friends have tested positive too. Prevention among IDUs failed. A growing number of new cases are among women who are not IDUs. It seems that prevention in this group is failing too. When my friends and I learned that treatment existed, we had hope for future. We were going to live, not to die. We were naive. We thought that if treatment existed, we would get it when we need it. We never imagined it could be otherwise. We started to work in hospitals helping HIV patients, and we saw that the reality is very different. People were dying. Because there was no enough treatment, doctors in the center developed commissions to decide who deserved to live and who will die. People were labeled social unproductive and denied treatment. Something had to be changed. We started to have demonstrations, speak to the media and show the world that we existed. But still people thought that we were guilty and we didn't deserve treatment. Octave have a saying, silence equals death. We were not silent. We were screamed, but nothing changed. At the time we began Frontades moving, we had illegal actions. We risked being sent to prison, but it was time to take that risk. We had nothing to lose. Frontades united not only people living in HIV/AIDS, but also anti-fascistic organizations. We called ourselves Frontades because it was a war for our lives. We started in Kaliningrad, where nearly 1,000 of people at that time already died without treatment. The aim of actions in Kaliningrad, Moscow, and St. Petersburg was to force the government to admit that we existed, that an epidemic existed, and that we had the right to treatment. Our aim was political will. After years of our protests and political actions, the Russian government increased funding for AIDS. High-level officials, including the president, recently recognized the problem and expressed political commitment to access to treatment. The government admitted that drug users have the right to live, but antiretrovirals still are not available to everyone, and there is a lot of work ahead. Problems started with procurement. There have been treatment interruptions because aid centers run out of drugs. Technical support and planning, forecast and delivery is needed. The system should become transparent to avoid corruption. Some have said that drug users shouldn't be given ARVs because they won't adhere. But the Russian government also had to be adhered to treatment to ensure sustainable medicine supplies. The regions supported by the Global Fund have sustainable ARVs delivery. The Global Fund has also provided the best treatment and prevention models in Russia and technical assistance that has been essential. But there are still problems to be overcome. Many patients don't know that treatment is available. Drug users are isolated. Even if they know that treatment exists, they have many fears and myths about it. They have learned to avoid all state institutions, pharmacies where you can't find a syringe, but you can always find a police patrol at the entrance. State-run detox centers where the best developed referral system is referral to the police. The lack of effective treatment of drug addiction costs problems for adherence for drug users. Substitution treatment with methadone and buprenorphine is illegal in Russia. And there is almost no access to drug-free rehabilitation. The only free drug addiction centers is religious programs and government-sponsored detox. But to get into these government-sponsored detox programs, you have to be officially registered as a drug user. Then police, employers, and others discriminate against you. Effective drug addiction treatment, essentially substitutional treatment, is needed to make it possible for drug users to succeed on ARV. As Alex Budik said that this week, the international debate on substitutional treatment is over. Russia must legalize methadone and buprenorphine immediately to help prevent and treat HIV. Until Russia legalizes substitutional treatment, ensures a steady supply of ARVs, develop integrated social support programs and end stigma and discrimination against people living with HIV/AIDS and vulnerable groups, access to antiretrovirals would be nothing more than an empty promise. The system of providing access to treatment in Russia is still sick and in need of treatment. The global system is also not working. Global initiatives have not been successful in providing treatment to more than 25% of those in need. Patient laws and intellectual property rights make ARVs too expensive for the patients who need them. Access to treatment is a problem that must be solved globally. Throughout the world, we have the same problems, and I can see that on this conference. As activists, we can't just work in our own countries. We have to unite internationally. Everyone in this room knows the price of an action. Death. Life depends on us. Thank you.
We'll have time to ask Sasha some questions here as well in a few minutes, but please, for the time being, welcome Musumbi Kanyoro to the podium, please.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Ladies and gentlemen, when one is presented with such a topic as this, the temptation is to come out with many statistics that show what the cost would be. And I was tempted to do that. When I was invited, I started to go through countries, go through different data, just to try to see what statistics that we have that are available. And I decided that I did not want to bring the statistics to this session, because I sincerely believe that there is not a person sitting in this room today who does not understand the consequences of inaction. In 2031, 25 years from now, there will be no one under the age of 50 who will be able to remember a world without AIDS. Every government official, every religious person, every grandmother will have lived through this pandemic. What story will they tell? We are responsible for shaping that story. The actions we take or fail to take now will shape the future and determine the story of tomorrow. Either we take hold of the future, or the future will take hold of us. If by 2031, millions of people are still becoming infected with HIV, it will not be because we did not act or understand the consequences of our inactions. It will be because we failed to apply the knowledge that we had gathered in these past 25 years. We have spent 25 years with the pandemic. We are smarter in how we live with it. We are better educated about the behavior of the virus. We are more highly skilled in how to prevent it. And indeed, we appreciate the role that leadership at every level, from every corner, can make a difference. Yet, I sincerely believe we are grossing over some important factors. I feel one of the critical areas that we have not stayed sufficiently with is to examine how we today live with ethical stance, with what we consider as values. Let me illustrate. The issue of mortality versus morality. The millions of lives lost cannot be ignored. And indeed, these statistics that we have are a tragic snapshot of the past, but they hint to a very frightful future. However, statistics say little about the wider context of the epidemic or its complex and diverse interconnections with major issues that we have been dealing with, such as our religious beliefs, the way that we manage economy, the way that we put security or peace or violence or gender disparity issues on the table, and how we interpret this. The imperatives of an ethical human society demand that we address AIDS with minds open to new standards and values. One's ethical stance is highly dependent on how they think that they ground themselves in values. We know that values are forged during defining moments. And my question then is, are these not the defining moments of the ethics of morality versus mortality? Yes, values carry us through tremendous times when change appears to be spinning endlessly. But AIDS has put a wedge on how we think about values. Today we must answer the question, can morality override mortality? How can we let people die because they don't meet what we consider as our moral standards? Is it ethical to let people die because they are poor and are not profitable drug clients? How much profit is ethical? How can something investing in war is more ethical than investing in peace? How ethical are budgets that are spent on war machines when millions are dying from poverty? These questions have lots of dollars attached to them, and they require responses from religions, from businesses, from governments, from individuals, and there are more questions that are ethical questions. Our responses will shape the story of the future. A second concern that I have is how we use the knowledge that we have gathered to be able to overpower this illness. And I have found that HIV has opened a Pandora box about how powerlessness translates into poverty and death. But we see changes here because no one could have thought of a history where we would have had a world meeting at the United Nations and listen to children and listen to sex workers and listen to drug users, etc. and central. But we are doing it today. But we are asked to do more. We have to be able to translate the positive story of what we are doing into all the areas of where leadership is needed. The moral issues here are how we value each and every person providing leadership, because our story of leadership has ended up into being a story of only political leadership. I know, working with women, when the home-based care women in the village are not providing the leadership, it does not matter how political leadership is able to be affirmed alone. I am asking that we put our force so that when we talk of leadership, we are able to talk of leadership at every level, at every level. Leadership that we need in our hospitals, leadership that we need in the homes, leadership that we need in the youth clubs, and leadership that we need in every level. And we have to be able to lift it up and provide the resources that are needed for that to be effective. And we need to be able to look at the mechanisms that make it possible. And finally, I hope that one of the lessons that we have learned in the last year is that in the last years is that we have to move away from creating any borders or boundaries. In order for us to do this, we need to move away from any isolationist research, from cloaking resources and lone ranger prevention, treatment or care. We need to move away from functionalism, and we need to move away from us and them, from the blames that we've had in the last few years. For lasting results, we must expect a lot from governments, but HIV/AIDS ask for more. As civil society, private sector, individuals join the table, the shape and the size and the table manners will change. We have to learn to work together well. We must work as teams and partners across the borders. And the cost of inaction, I think the cost of inaction is nothing less than a high moral failure that will shame our achievements for the last 21st centuries. It is too costly. You and I cannot afford that. The next 25 years need leaders who can go where angels dare not go. Thank you.
Our next speaker is just 21 years old. She's from Jamaica, as I mentioned. She started a youth group there when she was just 15. You're going to talk about the youth in the future. Please welcome Carol McKay.
Again, I want to say good morning to my fellow panelists, the adults present here in the audience, and the ones who I stand to represent this morning, the young people. reflecting on my challenges, failures, and successes of my over 6 years experience working as and with youths remind me that there is still a lot to be said and done. However, I will use this platform to address the most pressing. At the age of 9, I was told by my mom that my dad was HIV positive. Like most of the other youngsters I know at my age, I did not know exactly what she was talking about. The only thing I thought about was, Daddy is going to die. Daddy did not leave as soon as I thought he would. But living through the process with him was like I was being killed over and over again. I watched my childhood, self-esteem, innocence, and my father wasted away. And the worst thing about it was, I felt like there was nothing I could do about it. The day I feared most came. My father died. But I was lucky enough, unlike millions of other children, to after having lost my father to HIV, there was support from people who knew I needed it. Be it a phone call, monetary or other resources, a word of encouragement that ushered me into a role that later led to the mobilization of youngsters in and around my local town, Portland, Jamaica. Alongside with these other young people and a strong adult youth adult partnership, a partnership where young people were included in the decision-making process. Our concerns were heard and strong evidence of their inclusion could be seen. Wherever the adults were, we were in the midst making our contributions. And through this, we were able to develop and implement youth-friendly programs geared at tackling issues that bombarded youngsters in our homestead, and at the same time, offered a space for young people to be engaged in positive activities. But for a town that stretches northeast of the island with youngsters living in deep rural areas, the educated and the non-educated, heterosexuals and homosexuals, the rich and the poor, one youth-friendly center with limited resources was not able to stretch to the heights that the conditions demanded. Now, according to UNICEF, almost 12 million young people, ages 15 to 24, and 3 million children live with HIV and AIDS. The majority of new infections are among young people. 6,000 young people and almost 2,000 children become infected every day. Despite the HIV and AIDS information that has been disseminated, new infections among young people continues to escalate, and only a minority fraction of our young people infected have access to ARV medications or the knowledge about it. And the list goes on. For a world that has gone over 20 years with the epidemic, and still in my local town, Portland, Jamaica, kids whose parents are infected still are being discriminated against by teachers, students, community members, and worst yet, their own family members. Now this is a call for concern. Myths and conceptions that sex education should be tabooed still lingers in the minds of youngsters who are daily confronted with sexual choices. Despite the attempt to improve the standard of healthcare centers to upgrade the quality services offered to young people, there is still a high sense of stigma and discrimination faced by youngsters who try to access condoms and other services despite the information. We know that the face of HIV and AIDS is young. As the repeated statistics, we hear echoes volume. In order for us to have a future, we need to secure our young people. We need to be actively participating at all levels. HIV and AIDS is affecting the world, but the fastest and hardest hit is our young. Therefore, there is no need for convincing that the right mechanisms should be in place to combat this epidemic and fast. I took the liberty to ask youngsters in and around my local town what some of these mechanisms should be. Today, this morning, I represent the voices of those who are not able to stand before you and speak for themselves. In order to secure our future, we need quality sex education with a wider dissemination of messages. The provision of quality sex education in schools, churches, youth clubs, and other meeting grounds for youngsters is a must. This should include proper information on contraceptives, self-esteem, life skills, and the list goes on. We know that HIV and AIDS information cannot stand on its own. The space for freedom of opinions, the liberty to choose, and the environment to be yourself and to expose your concerns should be a must. On the contrary, however, that such a condition promotes early sexual activities should be revised, as effective sex education equips one with skills for better condom negotiation and the knowledge to know how to protect ourselves. Youth-friendly healthcare services. Healthcare centers that will offer equal treatment to young people despite their sexuality. This means that young people in poverty-stricken areas, the young homosexuals and bisexuals, the rich, the poor, the mentally challenged, the disabled, should be given the same privileges. In order to effectively and have a reduction in HIV/AIDS cases among young people, we should recognize that youths from all sectors of society must, and I repeat, must be placed equally on the agenda. A stronger platform to confront the challenges that the epidemic brings. This year's conference gives a much stronger participation to young people compared to previous years, and I applaud the organizers. However, this should be an ongoing inclusion that covers a wide cross-section of young people at different levels. Today, I will not say to our leaders, I will not say to those who have the resources to make a difference, foster the integration of these mechanisms, and we will have a decline in new infections among young people. Instead, I will say to them, think about what will happen if we do not include and integrate these mechanisms. There is nothing more to it. We are young. We are affected greatly, and we can make a difference. We want to play our part with your help. Thank you.
Carol McKay, again, just 21 years old. I have a passionate speech. I have a feeling we'll be hearing a lot from you over the years, for sure. Again, we want this to be as much about all of you as possible. There are four microphones throughout the room here, a lot of speakers. We're going to ask for questions, but let me just get things started. Mark Haywood, you got us right into it. You called for the resignation of the Minister of Health. Let me ask you something. With all that you know now and your work with the Law Project, how do you build political will? Not through just simple criticism, but how do you build political will with all that you know now?
I think you build political will by starting with the recognition at the highest level of government that AIDS is a threat to the development of developing countries. And from that recognition comes an understanding that government has a critical duty to coordinate society's efforts. We heard about the importance of leadership at every level, which I fully agree with. But you can have leadership at every level, but if there isn't a government at the center that encourages that leadership, that finds resources for it and gives it direction, then you've got a problem. And that's what we've seen in South Africa. We can say in South Africa proudly that we have a very large budget for HIV from our government, but our government continually downplays the deaths that are taking place because of HIV, continually downplays the science of what will save people's lives. And then we say, create hard targets. Monitor at all points your program. Evaluate your program. Improve your program where you identify the weaknesses. Political leadership can't be an ephemeral idea. It has to be something that is objectively measurable and objectively measured, and that's what we would expect.
And we will come back to this theme of hard targets quite a bit. And I apologize in advance, I'm having a hard time seeing, but I think there's a question over here. I ask you to go ahead and state your name, and if you represent a specific organization, state that as well, please.
Roger Deedles from UCLA. I applaud the first speaker in criticizing governments that do not take action. But I believe equally strongly that we should applaud governments that do take action. And therefore, I wanted to set the record straight. The Premier and the Minister of Health of China have visited AIDS patients and visited in AIDS hospitals, have visited AIDS patients in their homes. China has passed a law that every person who needs treatment for HIV/AIDS in China will have access to treatment. That includes commercial sex workers, men who have sex with men, injection drug users. They have made the official policy to implement methadone maintenance clinics and needle exchange programs. There are currently more needle exchange programs and methadone maintenance clinics in China that all of the rest of Asia put together. They have passed an anti-discrimination law. And finally, they have provided free education for all children who are affected by HIV/AIDS. China was slow to begin, but it has now begun. And I think we need to applaud countries that have taken dramatic action right from the top, as you have said. Thank you.
Thank you. And let me just add as well, as you state your name and your organization, let's make this a dialogue. I don't want to get statements as much from the audience as questions. We do have a crack panel here, so let's see if we can get to as much of that as possible. Please.
Irene Adams from the Amor Clinic in Brazil. I have a question. Could you all talk just a little bit about the role of spiritual leaders in promoting awareness, prevention, solidarity, reducing stigma, and the role of spiritual leaders even in care?
Spiritual leadership. Musimbi, do you want to take that one to start off with?
Sure. Yes. One can never underestimate what the spiritual leaders could be. I certainly believe that every person is a spiritual person of some sort. But the leadership by the spiritual leader has authority in the sense that they have not only the numeracy of people, but they also have the presence with people at the time of the most needs. And I believe that at the present time, I can be able to vouch to that because of even the pre-meeting that took place. At the present time, many, many spiritual leaders are engaged in what began as a very slow start. And like the previous speaker, I would want us to affirm that and even ask for more involvement of spiritual leaders.
And Sasha, let me just twist it a little bit. When you talk about political will, and you talking about your remarks, are you thinking about spiritual leaders specifically as well as part of either getting that political will or as part of the political will you want to get?
Well, what I think about the political will, and Russia is showing that for us, that it's like, it's not it, you know? Well, having a political will doesn't solve all the problems. It's just the beginning, you know? We're moving to the aim. We're having it.
Okay, great, thank you. Please, next.
Annabel Cannabis from Avert in the UK. Each year, 500,000 children are being born infected with HIV, yet we've known for 10 years how to prevent transmission from mother to child. Why are we not this week calling for, indeed demanding, a worldwide scale-up, an urgent scale-up of prevention of mother-to-child transmission efforts? Why are we spending so much time discussing new prevention methods, discussing microbicides which don't even exist, discussing treatment for children, when what we could be doing is preventing these children being born infected in the first place?
Well, let me frame that a little bit for our panel. There was a lot of discussion about microbicides this week, and I think it's probably important to set the record straight. Does anybody want to talk specifically about microbicides? And does that sometimes, the newer prevention methods, get in the way of chewed and tried prevention methods? Does it sort of take away from that? Does anybody want to take that? Mark, do you want to address that?
I think I agree with the speaker. Microbicides are incredibly important for all the reasons that have been said in this conference, and the urgency of finding an effective microbicide can't be overemphasized. But I think that we tend to overlook the prevention tools that we had. 6 years ago in Durban, our ability to prevent mother-to-child transmission with a relatively simple dose of nevirapine at that point was the news of the conference. That was what the excitement was about. But today, globally, only 9% of mothers and parents are accessing those services. So again, it goes back to political leadership. Why is it that a relatively simple health intervention is not being implemented in most countries in the world, with a consequence for children and parents which is terribly frightening to think of? So keep our eyes on what we have, but at the same time push for what we need.
I think well said. I know we're asking, but I can't see the other microphones. Is anybody else lined up at the other microphones? Everyone's over here? Okay, let's keep going. Your name and your organization?
Lisa Foreman from the University of Toronto Effective Law. It's more a comment than a question to Ms. Simbi. I really appreciated your comments about morality, but I think we should be very careful not to cede the language of morality to those who seek to use it as a weapon against affected communities and as a tool to deny them access to essential preventive and treatment standards services. Morality is a standard that we should all use to judge our leaders and to hold them accountable, and we should see morality as intimately intertwined with human rights standards. And we should be asking, what is the morality of denying access to condoms and safe injection sites? What's the morality of leaders failing to fund AIDS globally when resources so readily flow into war, trade, and affluent lifestyles? And what is the morality of political inaction, whether it's by Thabo Mbeki or by Stephen Harper's shameful failure to attend this conference?
Lucinda, you did talk a lot about morality versus mortality. And maybe you can, as simply as you can, talk about, does one get in the way of the other? Can you have morality in the truest sense of the word without it somehow increasing mortality or changing the way we look at mortality?
I think the questioner really has the tone to which I was also asking similar questions. I certainly believe that you can't have a world in which there are no values. There will be values. But the deciding moment of how these values are framed is important. And my argument there is that we need to see what is happening now and define the values that we have in regards to our world today based on what the realities are, not on wishful thinking, not on wishful thinking at all. So it's to stop being judgmental, but rather to respond as persons who value the humanity as a whole, using the human rights framework, but also raising it to a way in which
we are able to save lives. That's important to me.
Thank you, Musimbi. Please, sir, your name and your organization.
My name is Alan Whiteside. I'm from the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. 25 years into this epidemic and 20 years of working in it, I am angry, frustrated, and emotional. But remember, South Africa isn't alone in lacking leadership. India denies its data. Swaziland has 25% more infections than South Africa. In Zimbabwe, the president is making the many HIV-positive homeless, and they cannot afford to eat. The OECD countries, who is holding the G8 accountable for the promises made and not kept? Who is monitoring the trade agreements that are making people jobless? The next 5 years needs to be about social mobilization, about equity, gender, and development. And my question to the panel is, what does it take to take this audience and make us a broader, more active audience and reach other people? We need social mobilization. Thank you.
Hey, Carol McKay, let me ask you, because you talk a lot about the youth and the future, and I think in so many ways you represent that. And when you talk about social mobilization, you cannot ignore the youth. How do you respond to him? What does social mobilization mean to you, and how do you get it done?
I think in order to allow young people to feel like they are a part of the response, is that adults, you know, the ones who have the resources and stuff, they need to give us that platform where we feel like we are being included. So, you know, there are decision makings going on. You know, young people need to feel like, okay, I'm a part of that. And when we feel like, okay, we are actively participating in what is going on and not just passively sitting back and have everything thrown to us, then you will get more young people, you know, socially involved, you know, mobilized and wanting to do stuff, because they're not just given the recommendations, but they are also involved in making the recommendations. So it's the strategy to use is to get young people involved.
Does a conference like this do that for you? I mean, when you attend the International AIDS Conference, what is the perception among young people about what this conference actually achieves?
For this year's conference, I am very impressed. You know, I feel like we as young people have been given a platform to address our issues, to address the challenges that we have, to make the world know the successes, the things that we have been doing, and also to allow everyone to know what has been going on with young people. But at the same time, you know, it is very interesting that, you know, I think about it that, okay, we have been given such a wonderful platform and all of this has been happening. But then after this, you know, the recommendations that we make, you know, will they stop here at the convention center? You know, the things that we share, will they all stop here? Or after this, you know, adults will take our recommendations seriously and start thinking, how can we include young people? You know, I also challenge young people, after leaving here, our recommendations and our passion for what we are talking about, does it stop here? Or we will leave and go back to our countries and actively get involved and press. If the adults, you know, want to allow our recommendations to be fallen on deaf ears, you know, that we will get up and say, listen, we spoke, you guys, you know, made commitments, now we want a follow-through. We want our recommendations to be taken upon.
Well said. Please.
My name is Stella Iwagu of Center for the Right to Health, Nigeria. When McKay Wood talked about political leadership, like everybody has talked about, and the importance of other countries coming together and putting pressure on affirming human rights that had been declared and collectively signed, it really calls to mind, to what extent can we influence the judiciary and the legal community to also play their role? They seem to be very silent, and over and over we have stated that stigma and discrimination is a deterrent to the progress in HIV/AIDS control. In Nigeria, for the past 5 to 6 years, we have a case of a nurse aide that was terminated from her job as a nurse, and it was clearly written that the reason for the termination was because of her HIV/AIDS status. That case went to court, and the judge would not even let her come into the court. She needed evidence from Canada, US, and Europe to state that, to see that the people in the courtroom will be safe That is the level of ignorance, that's the level of stigma, that's the level of discrimination within the judiciary that is supposed to affirm this right. 6 years down the line, this case is still on appeal. And this woman is barely living. For how long will justice take? We have another case against the government of Lagos State, where a woman who is supposed to have, who was very sick, having diarrhea and vomiting, was taken to the hospital, and they refused her care because she's HIV positive. That case has been in court for the past 3 years. And at some point, we tried to use the use of pseudonym because of stigma and discrimination. People living with HIV AIDS cannot even use legal and judicial resources to affirm their rights. And we had asked for the use of pseudonym to protect the privacy of this client. But again, that has been thrown out. How can you enforce human rights when the judiciary and the legal community are being an obstacle? How can we mobilize leadership in that area? Thank you.
You know, Mark Haywood, I can't help but think as she's talking that that is the price of inaction in so many ways, right? I mean, we're talking about the judiciary here and not being able to get the simplest sort of beliefs about what we already know about HIV/AIDS across to people who should be making these decisions. You work with the AIDS Law Project. What happens in a situation like this? First of all, how do you convince people just get them the basic knowledge and then to act upon it?
Well, what I would say is that, you know, the judiciary is a constituency that needs to be educated about HIV as much as any other constituency. And in some countries, it's very powerful because we talk about or we encourage people to use the law to protect their human rights, to use the courts to protect their human rights. And if they go to the courts and they encounter stigma and they encounter discrimination and they encounter indignities, then what it does is those people give up faith in legal processes and retreat into their own stigma and their own fears and in their own inability to talk to other people. So I agree with the speaker. But again, I would say that there's many aspects to working with the judiciary. Let me give you one example. And again, it comes back to the question of political commitment. In the last few weeks, we have taken a case to court on behalf of prisoners in South Africa who are being denied access to treatment. Our judiciary, the judge in this case, supported our argument and gave us a judgment instructing that the prisoners should be treated. But the government refused to comply with parts of that order, and last week, one of those prisoners died. That was contempt of court, contempt of the judiciary. So there are critical series of issues that need to be addressed.
Thank you. Mark, you know, I mean, and I want to sort of make this as simple as possible for people, but when we talk specifically about the judiciary, it seems like that would be a starting step in terms of actually trying to get things done. I mean, 25 years, as one of our previous questioners asked, how can there be such a fundamental lack of knowledge among people who are educated making decisions on behalf of the entire country?
Well, I think that's the problem.
Let me more straightforward. Is it a lack of education or is it a lack of wanting to be educated?
It's a lack of both. The shocking thing is that outside of conferences like this, the level of knowledge about HIV remains extremely low. There's an awareness of HIV, but knowledge is very, very low, and that includes amongst the judiciary. But the problem is compounded by the fact that there's no desire to know. There are certain parts of our countries and our constituencies that don't want to know because they think that they're not affected. Governments that think they're not affected, judges that think they're not affected, business people that think they're not affected, religious leaders that think they're not affected. So that remains a challenge for all of us. And as Carol was saying, that is the job of education and particularly of community activists.
All right, we're going to keep on theme here. Please, go ahead and state your name and your organization.
I'm Diane Riley. I'm with the International Harm Reduction Network for Youth. And I have a comment and a question. The comment is that given that in many parts of the world now it's injecting drug use that's driving the pandemic, given that outside Africa one-third of HIV cases are related to injection drug use, the need to call attention to the fact that that is related to drug prohibition and a policy that's driven by the policies of the United States and the United Nations. And we must call attention to that and stop ignoring it at these conferences. The question relates to another point. The point is that the majority of people who are using drugs are youth. The majority becoming infected are youth. Many of those are street children. Their voices are missing from this conference and elsewhere. I'd like the panelists to comment on that and the need for honest harm reduction education for youth. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we have talked about that somewhat in all fairness, but, and Carol, you've done a terrific job. But Sasha, let me ask you, when we talk about youth specifically, it seems like you cannot have conferences like this without incorporating their voices into that. We heard from Carol. What is your impression? Is enough happening?
Well, I think it's not enough, of course. And I think that, well, people are, such people as drug users have to be involved more, and their voices have to be heard more stronger at the conferences like that. And they have to be involved more in the advocacy movement. And that is how, well, this is my experience, actually, of fighting for a right to the treatment, fighting for the right to live. So, and that's my personal experience. I know that it works and how it works. And I think that actually a lot, yes, political leadership, and things like that, but a lot depends on people themselves, how they're involved in all that. And I'm very, you know, disappointed when the, again and again in many countries I started this discussing about harm reduction. I think that it's clear for, well, I hope that it has to be clear for everybody that, well, look at the results. If the harm reduction project, harm reduction education is provided, it really works. And if it is not, and it is the experience of Russia, where all that programs were forbidden and were not equally realized, so the prevention among the abuse failed, and stigma and discrimination is like not working. It's not, you know, the question of morality or not morality. What is working? What will work? That is the point from my point of view.
And Sasha, you talk a lot specifically about governments, and I'm reading some of the signs here as well. We all deserve to live, political leadership now, hold governments accountable. You know, it's interesting, Mark, as I mentioned in the early remarks, I've come to a lot of these conferences. Is that the theme in Toronto, holding governments accountable? Is that what we're talking about this year in 2006?
Well, I think it's more than holding governments accountable. It's about making governments work on HIV and AIDS. Again, as Peter Peart said, we have many resources. We know how to prevent mother-to-child transmission. We know how to keep people who have HIV alive with antiretroviral medicines. We have more money than we've ever had before. But at the end of the day, governments have power, and governments have a responsibility to make sure that those advances are put into place. So, yes, accountability, but side by side with accountability, finding a way forward. In New York in June this year, governments agreed in the political declaration to set targets by the end of 2006 for HIV prevention, HIV treatment, and HIV care. We have to make sure that those targets are indeed set and that those targets are as ambitious as possible, because those targets have the potential to turn around the AIDS epidemic. And I believe, you know, we can't just let something like the UN meeting happen and then we forget it and we move on to Toronto and then we all have a big party here and then we forget Toronto and we move on to somewhere else. And behind all of us, as one of the speakers said, is 40 million people in this world who live with HIV, who don't come and stay in posh hotels, who can't walk the streets of Toronto, sit on these stages. And our duty is to those people. And I would say to people here, in answer to what Alan Whiteside said, let's make the next step this year World AIDS Day, 1st of December 2006. Make it the theme. Hold governments accountable, deliver the targets for HIV prevention and care.
Cindy?
I agree with that entirely, but I think that the step that we need to take is how we empower the people in the nations or how people get empowered to hold the governments accountable. Because it's one thing to say hold governments accountable, but if the people of those particular places do not know how to, it doesn't get done. And this is why I really cry for recognizing the leadership that can come from within, and especially the leadership that can come from the local places. We've seen of late the political changes that we've had in the whole world. It is because the people stood up and said no, that we had the walls go down. We have to be able to make it possible for us as the people to stand up and say no, and say to the government, take up your leadership.
Thank you, Ms. Cindy, as well. Please, your name and your organization, please.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Sushila Ramachandran, and I'm here representing the Toronto Youth Force. First of all, I would like to thank Carol McKay for presenting in this plenary session and showcasing the importance of youth leadership in the response to the global pandemic of AIDS. Now for my question. This is for Carol McKay. What do you feel is lacking in the youth response to the global pandemic on AIDS, and what void do we need to fill? Thank you.
What is lacking, as my fellow panelists say here, is that young people know what they want. We know what we want, we know what our challenges are, but the thing is, we don't know how, the necessary skills to really go about getting what we want effectively done. We don't really have all those skills. And I think what we need to do as young people is to come together and work on getting those skills. You know, how is it that when you are addressing political leaders, to go about it, and when you are finished, that you have the recommendations that we made are met? You know, how is it that you go about, you know, talking to when you meet with researchers and whoever it is, when we are finished, they know that, okay, these youngsters know what they want. They are serious about it, and they're not going to stop until we deliver.
Very well said. Please, your name, your organization, please.
My name is Zhenyu Wu from China. I have a response to the first speaker, Mike. Thank you very much, concerned about China. Thank you for care about China. And also thank you for your effort to study China. I have one question and two invitations. The question is for you compared and the quote for 2010, China predicted has 10 million HIV infection. Where it's come from? Where's the citation? And WHO, UNAIDS, we checked. We cannot find credibility resource for that citation. If you could provide that citation, I appreciate it. I have two invitations to you. And in the next session, start 10:45, in the session 11, I will talk about how China moving from science to policy to law, moving from a pilot to scaling up. I also extend the second invitation. I invite you to visit China. I could make arrangement for you to meet with high government officials. You talk with government officials. I could also make arrangement for you to talk with sex workers in the outreach program. I could arrange you to talk with injecting drug users who are in medical maintenance program, who are in needle exchange program. I could also make arrangement for you to talk with men who have sex with men who are in the prevention program. I could also invite you to talk with people in free HIV treatment program. Whoever you want to talk, we could make arrangement for you. Thank you.
I think I must clarify my comments on China. What I'm saying about China is that vigilance and support from the global community for the Chinese epidemic and for Chinese people living with HIV is absolutely essential, particularly when there are projections of an explosion of the Chinese epidemic. The statistic that I referred to, or the projection, comes from WHO and UNAIDS, and I can show you exactly where. It's also a projection that is found in China's application to the Global Fund to show the possibility of the epidemic taking off. And what I'd like to say is that I think that China shows
the gulf that sometimes exists between civil society and between government. It's not good enough at this stage of the epidemic for political leaders to get credit for visiting people who live with HIV. We are past that. That was something that we praised 15 or 20 years ago. We want more than that now. In China, my concerns are that activists are still being imprisoned. 3 weeks ago, a person with HIV who went to Beijing to petition for compensation was put in prison for trying to get compensation. That's a human rights violation, and the Chinese government must commit to stopping that. I'm concerned that if we talk about human rights and we talk about the vulnerability of women and sex workers to HIV infection, that the continued criminalization of sex work in China places potentially tens or hundreds of thousands of Chinese women at risk of HIV infection. So as a human rights activist, I ask for China to decriminalize sex work and to make it easier to facilitate HIV prevention. But don't get me wrong, I care about China very much, and my comments are made not in order to attack the Chinese government, which shows some signs of a growing commitment to HIV, but to call for support, but for support that is based on the human rights that we accept internationally.
You know, this is the best part of this whole session, is when you can have these sorts of dialogues. And in that spirit, let me just say, because I think it's only fair, if there's anybody here from the South African Health Minister's office, I'd invite you to one of the microphones over here to continue some of that dialogue as well.
The minister is there.
We have two microphones over here and another microphone over here. We have 15 minutes left. Anybody from that office, please speak up. In the meantime, please.
She's right there.
Oh my God. I'm not gonna put anybody on the spot, but the microphones are open. If you want to go to the microphone, please go ahead. Please, your name, your organization, your question.
Hi, I'm Jerry Clout. I'm the youth ambassador of Patrick for Life in North Bay, Ontario. I hear the message from all countries that education of youth is so important. Yet I'm a 13-year-old Canadian who is not educated about HIV/AIDS in the school systems. How do we get that to happen before it's too late?
Well, you know, Carol, that sort of talks again. We talk so much at these conferences about all the things that are happening, but sometimes, again, we forget some of the most basic things. A 13-year-old not being educated, that's very surprising to me, shocking, actually. What do you say?
Yes, it is indeed very shocking to me that, you know, a 13-year-old in high school is not being educated. And again, it goes to show us, you know, the consequences of inaction, you know, us not doing enough, like the government not doing enough, because it goes to show that the government not doing enough. And I think what we need to do now as young people is that, you know, the things that you are facing, and it's time for us to talk to our teachers, let them know, listen to me, these are the things that I am facing. And the thing is, students look up a lot. They look up to their teachers. Teachers are like role models to a lot of students. And so what we need to do is to talk to them. Let them know, listen, this, I need information on this. You know, and the thing is, if you're not getting it in school and you feel like, okay, I am not getting the results that I want, also we can take up the responsibility of going to get that information for ourselves.
It's some autonomy and some self-motivation required for sure, but hopefully we're going to get beyond that as well. Again, just a few minutes left. If anyone from the minister's office wants to come to the microphones, please. Your question.
Hi, I'm Mariam Shamanesh. I work in Goa, India, and University College London. And I kind of like the idea of the ministers being held accountable and ministers of health resigning. There would be many heads on the block at this stage looking at the past 25 years. And I'm just wondering, going back to issues again, being repeated over and over again, we know that harm reduction ideas work. We know that decriminalization of sex workers are likely to work. We know that universal access is a right in terms of life, and therefore not inaction may be a crime against humanity, as it's beautifully said at the back there. Can we use international courts of law at this stage to take governments to those courts and hold them accountable? And I wonder if the panelists have any experience of that leverage being useful or something that we can use firstly. Secondly, going to the USA, the most strong nation able to wage wars everywhere in the world, as we can see, what do the panelists think in terms of this free market ideology plus fundamentalist ideology really driving their anti-HIV agenda with the anti-prostitution laws that they're bringing in tied to their US aid, with the anti-harm reduction that their IDU harm reduction they're taking to all the policy meetings at high levels, and the abstinence-only policy, and how, again, as if we're talking about political action, practically what we can do to take that forward rather than just conference after conference saying inaction is leading to lives. What is the practical fusions maybe we can have between the anti-AIDS movement and many other anti-globalization movements that are taking this agenda forward at other levels in terms of agriculture, free trade policy, etc., etc.?
Good question. Lots of questions actually wrapped into that. Mark, you want to tackle the first one, talking specifically about the role of the courts and the judicial system. Again, a little bit of a change of the question previously.
Sorry, I didn't quite get...
Well, I think in terms of what accountability the judicial system has in being able to enforce some of the things that we're talking about here.
Well, I think it depends from country to country in terms of the role of the judiciary and the status of the judiciary. In South Africa, we've got a judiciary which protects our human rights based on the South African constitution, says people have a right to health, people have a right to dignity, and so on. And as activists, we've used that human right, the judiciary, with legal cases which have instructed our government to provide mother-to-child transmission services to pregnant women who have HIV. We've used it to instruct our government to provide access to treatment for prisoners who have HIV, although the government has defied that court order. But there will be some countries like Canada where the judiciary can play a role. There may be other countries like Zimbabwe or certain other countries where the judiciary is marginalized and where the judiciary is effectively not independent from government. But the overriding principle is that law and human rights and the use of law and human rights is a vital aspect of HIV prevention and of the general response to this epidemic.
And I know we didn't get to all the points in your question. I don't know where you just sat down, and I apologize for that. I also apologize that we only have a couple of minutes remaining. And I'll ask our panelists if you could stick around a bit after the presentation's over to answer any further questions. Again, a final offer to the South African Ministry's office if you want to have a little bit of a dialogue here before we wrap this session up. But as we have just a couple minutes left, I want to ask each of you to help sum up for me in terms of specifically, again, talking about this conference. This is a huge audience here. This is the first time we've had a session like this where we can have a dialogue. Is it working? Is enough being done? Is this worthwhile to have these sorts of discussions? Whoever wants to start. Sasha, why don't you start?
Well, I actually want to comment a bit about the previous question about, what I think about that is that the whole system of the intellectual property of solving such questions of the access to the treatment for infection and disease is have to be taken from this, market system. It have to be like plan system. All that patent laws have to be somehow denied. And that is, well, the idea that the activists we all see that it is not effective already to work in each country trying to lower the prices on the treatment. It's better to unite our efforts and try to change the whole system. This was, well, actually my idea about that. And thank you for your question.
I would like to follow on
this. Actually, let me just interrupt. Are you with the minister's office, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, please, I would love to hear from you. Go ahead.
I'm a program manager in the Ministry of Health in South Africa. I just want to talk about targets. There have been studies that have been from people from the United States, not from my country, which tell us that South Africa has got the highest adherence of antiretrovirals in the world. And South Africa has treated more people in the comprehensive treatment with antiretrovirals in the world. So I would like to ask our partners to not to get stuck in the five-year remark that came up, because South Africa, the South African government takes into consideration each and every player. It could be traditional healer or anybody. They give everybody an ear to listen. And me working as a program manager, I've got a lot of budget to play around with. And I'm proud that there hasn't been any constraints in me choosing how to use the budget. My business plan has never been restricted. So I've got a lot of power in using the budget to implement programs in the policies. So if only we could now applaud the achievements that have been made now, which the other world, people outside South Africa are saying that we have implemented better than anybody else in the world. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to the microphone as well. And we are unfortunately running out of time, but Mark, you need to respond to that. I mean, this is what it's about, this dialogue.
Yeah. Well, thank you. What I'd like to start by saying is that on the parts of the Treatment Action Campaign and civil society broadly, there's a desperate desire to work with the South African government to ensure that as much people as possible are treated with HIV and that we are as effective as possible in preventing HIV. But what I have to say to my colleague is that the statistics that I showed were not statistics that I imagined. I'm not misleading this conference. Those are government statistics that show the numbers of people dying, that show the levels of HIV infection. So my reply to the colleague would be to say, okay, let's agree on targets. Let's agree on trying to cut the rates of new HIV infections by 20 or 30% by the year 2008. Let's agree on 500,000 people on treatment by the year 2008. Let's agree on 80% coverage for mother-to-child prevention by 2008. If we can agree on those targets, you will find that you have 150% support of South African society and 150% support of the global community, because you will be turning the tide of this epidemic.
Unfortunately, we're at time. I'm sorry, I hate to end it so unceremoniously, but Mark Haywood, thank you so much, Sasha, Musimbi, Carol. Please, a warm round of applause for all of our panelists. I'm going to ask them to stick around for a few minutes to answer your questions. I hope you enjoyed this panel. Thank you very much.